This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Good day, greetings, hello. It's Art at the End of the World, the podcast that features artists, entertainers, and cultural leaders speaking about what it is to make art here at the end. My name is Mark Wigmore. Welcome to Art at the End of the World Remix. And the basic idea here is that we take episodes from our first season of the podcast and we rework, reuse, remix, recycle. And here at the end, right? We need to recycle. It is our debut season here on the Zoomer Podcast Network and at the new Classical FM, classicalfm.ca. So this is a great chance for people who maybe missed the episodes last time around to hear them fresh. If you are tuning in for the first time, welcome. My name is Mark Wigmore, host of The Oasis on the new Classical FM in Toronto, Coburg, Collingwood, around the world at classicalfm.ca. Heard 3 to 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, weekdays, if you want to listen either on the radio or on the website. So this is my podcast. We started it about a year ago, and it's a show that welcomes people who are changing culture through arts and what they put out into the world. Maybe that's not the goal necessarily, but of course we know that that's what art does. It reflects, it helps us rethink the world around us, perhaps empathize with people around us. And it's exciting to learn about an artist's process and how they got to where they are now and learn a little more about what it is they make and their ideas about this wild world around us right now. So, I implore you to have a listen to episode 1, which came out on Monday with Montreal's Alexandra Streliski, the composer and musician, piano player. Just so great to speak with her. I got so much out of it. And you can check out that Inscape record. Inscape is the name. And if you haven't had a chance, stream it or download it. Before we get into this week's remix, this episode is sponsored by Crow's Theater, one of this country's most acclaimed arts organizations and based in Toronto's vibrant East End community. Crow's creates unforgettable theater that examines and illuminates the pivotal narratives of our times. Crowstheater.com for info and tickets to what they're up to. And don't forget Julius Caesar, the urgently contemporary version on stage at Crow's through February 2nd. It is great. I went to see it a couple weeks back. Also, we're sponsored by Red Eye Media, a leading arts and entertainment communications company working with award-winning clients including Crow's Theater, the Musical Stage Company, Summerworks Performance Festival, and others. To find out more about that team, redeyemedia.ca. All right, so Karen Robinson is my remix guest today. We recorded this back in early 2019, not far away from my house. I just had to drive about 1 minute away. She is a beloved fixture of the Canadian theater scene, a cast member on the ever-popular CBC Pop Netflix collaboration Schitt's Creek. And if you would like to hear all 6 of my interviews with the cast members of that program, including Dan Levy, Eugene Levy, Catherine O'Hara, Annie Murphy, Noah Reed, and now Karen Robinson, you can actually just head to the original artattheendoftheworld.com website and the complete masterworks, I call that collection. They're all available on a blog post. Now, I allude to this story in the interview, but Karen and I first met under very celebratory circumstances. Back in 2018, I was asked to host the big Schitt's Creek fan event at Tiff Bell Lightbox in Toronto. Hundreds of people there. Gosh, I was nervous. And I was on stage with the entire Rose family for about an hour. And we did a moderated Q&A, watched a couple episodes. It was just so much fun. Big glitzy night. I don't think they would necessarily ask me again. I think they have probably, you know, Ryan Seacrest would do it or something next time. But it was great. And Karen and I had dinner that evening. And when we were putting together the idea for this podcast, I knew she would be just a perfect person to talk to about the art form of acting, but also get her gauge on cultural changes and changes in the theater business that she's witnessed as a Black woman working within the Canadian scene. It's also just really fun to talk about Schitt's Creek, and it's in its final season, and just great, by the way. One of the themes that comes up a lot on this podcast is that it's hard to move the needle in any profession, and that certainly includes the arts. And it's hard to change perceptions. It's hard to change people's mind, ideas around what stories get told, how we tell them, and who we champion in the theater and screen business. And Karen is an excellent example of just a real trooper who's all about craft and perseverance. It's all about the work. And, you know, you worry about the cultural changes as they come. She was involved in high school and university theater. Then she went to Mirvish, Soul Pepper, the Stratford Festival, Canadian Stage, on and on and on. And one section of this conversation is about her role in Prince Hamlet, which was a very ambitious and contemporary production in 2019, a remixing of the classic Shakespeare story. So we'll get to more on that in just a moment. She plays the generally unimpressed Schitt's Creek City Council member Ronnie on the program, and she's so good at it. Just a great person, a thoughtful person. So here we go. From Karen's dining room in Toronto's East End, here's my conversation with Karen Robinson on Art at the End of the World, Remix. Projection? Is that something you had to work on?
No. No, it's never something that I have to work on. Clarity, maybe so. Yeah, but projection, I've always been loud.
Because I could hear you loud and clear.
Really?
Last night, yeah.
Were you in the balcony?
No. Well, I was in the back row of the front area, or
okay,
the bottom section there.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, you sounded great.
That's good. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So that's one thing that I don't have to worry about.
So the last time we hung out was...
A year ago, wasn't it, sort of?
The season premiere of Schitt's Creek season 4.
Yeah.
We were at TIFF Bell Lightbox.
Yeah.
And what a night it was. We started out, we had to take some photos.
Yeah.
Very glamorous.
I know. Never done that before. Not that I can remember. It was. Yeah, but I didn't know what I was doing. It was
Was so much fun. And then afterwards, I got on stage with the Rose family and did, you know, Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara and Annie and Dan. And then afterwards, we all went out for a fancy dinner.
It was so fancy. I remember the yellow roses and the personal menus and the table settings and the light and the sparkle and the...
I felt kind of glamorous and you know, just I could see the fame over the crest of the hill.
I know. Sort of north of us.
That's
was
right.
The fame.
And Mary Margaret O'Hara was there, and Robin Duke was there, and
come on,
it was the coolest.
It's like the glitterati, something. It was amazing.
I noticed that this year it seemed like even a bigger deal for season 5. I mean, there was a lot of like Sony Center, and they were traveling different towns.
Yeah. I think they've taken a different tactic this time. They're doing, they're touring a show called Schitt's Creek up close and personal,
right?
And so many of the Rose family and their, you know, their TV partners have all been going to different American cities. In a couple of weeks, we're going to be here in Toronto.
You're going to be a part of it,
and I'm going to be a part of it.
That's
here
gonna
in
be
Toronto.
Great.
I hope so. Yeah. The fans go crazy.
They kind of go bananas, right?
They go bananas. Like, these events sell out in a number of hours or something like that. And you know, and they've had things like proposals happen at the events.
Right.
The cast members are just over the moon about it, and the fans are equally, if not more so. And so everybody's just having a good time.
I want to get to this part of your career a little more in depth and as we get into the conversation.
Yeah.
But I will point out that it seemed like this time around, you know, New Yorker articles, New York Times, Vanity Fair.
Yeah.
It really seemed like the Americans finally picked up the ball.
I noticed that too. And yesterday, I think it helps when Carol Burnett goes, you know, national, if not international, to say she watches the show.
I think Mariah Carey.
When Mariah Carey starts tweeting about the show, there are all these people. Helen Hunt is asking, why is this show not nominated for Emmys? I think Netflix really took the show to another level in terms of viewership, in terms of accessibility, and people are responding in a way that is, well, it's kind of not surprising because I always knew that, you know, we were part of a special thing,
right?
But I didn't understand what it would mean for Schitt's Creek on a global scale and what it would mean for me on a local scale, because I'm still a girl who takes a streetcar.
Sure.
But now I'm the girl who better behave herself on the streetcar, because...
Anybody call out for Ronnie these days or what?
People.
A little bit.
It keeps happening. It keeps happening.
Is that a first?
No, not necessarily, because, you know, people, there have been a few other things, and people know me from theater. But what happens now is, either people are bold enough to come up to me and tell me that they really enjoyed the show, which I love. I think that's a wonderful thing. Or people see me, I see the recognition in their eyes, and they nod and say hi, like we're friends.
Right.
And then they're the people who see me and then see them.
Right.
And then look away.
Right.
Because they're like, I don't want to get into her space, or, you know, they feel self-conscious or whatever. So
that would be the Canadian.
That would be the typical Canadian thing. That'd be the thing that I would
do. I just wouldn't want to bother. I'm such a fan, but I want to look, and I don't.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty great.
You know, actually, speaking of all that, I was with a student from Berkeley in Boston just the other day, and he said all the kids are watching it down there. Isn't it something?
It is. It really is. Yeah. It really is.
And in New York.
Kudos to Dan and Eugene, who were the initial creators, and everybody that they've brought on board. It's a family affair, more so than, you know, than just the Levies, even though I think that, you know, Dan and Eugene are, it's their baby.
And Eugene's brother is hanging around.
Fred is an executive producer. He's great. He's
such a Levy.
I know. And they come to see my plays. Yeah. And they're just salt of the earth. Great, great people. I lucked out.
Yeah, no kidding. So last night I saw you at the Berkeley Street Theater as part of the Canadian Stage. Why Not Theater's
production of Prince Hamlet, presented by Canadian Stage.
Ravi Jain, the director, and of course he's been busy guy for many, many years, just like you. But I can't help but be reminded that one of the images a little bit burned into my brain right now.
I know where you're going right now. We get that clothes on, though.
A bit of a suggestive scene with my friend Karen Robinson.
Yeah. Well, you know, Karen Robinson has many sides. And you're meant to imagine them as you go through, we go through that particular scene. That was a suggestion, actually, of Ravi Jain's and my wonderful partner in sex, on stage, Rick Roberts, who is just the most terrific actor and acting partner.
Pretty handsome.
I haven't noticed. Really? I haven't noticed the hair. And the sculpted features and all of that.
Right, sure.
He is so wonderful to be on stage with, and so fully trusting and trustworthy.
Yeah.
So the idea is that, you know, Claudius and Gertrude, who are Hamlet's stepfather and Gertrude is Hamlet's mother.
Right.
Have loud sex.
They do.
Which makes sense for how troubled Hamlet is for 3 hours of
generally an unhappy person.
Generally.
Yeah.
A bit melancholy. Just a little bit down. Blue. Anyway, it makes sense that he hates the idea that his mother has married so soon after his father's death, has married his father's brother,
right.
And you know, and seems to be completely oblivious to, you know, to what that means, for how that might look, how that might seem to people, and are having loud sex.
And this production in particular, everything is sort of reversed and turned around and put upside down.
Yeah.
And it takes a little bit for your brain to adjust to everything that's happening.
Yeah, yeah, because
there's a lot of different traditional male characters have been turned to female.
Absolutely.
We've got somebody signing on stage throughout the entire production. It's quite a feat in its own way.
I think so. I think Ravi Jain, with his big brain and his huge heart, started to ask himself the question, really ask himself the question, who gets to tell the story? Because there are all kinds of traditional ways that we think about storytelling, and you know, and that tends to be exclusionary, whether we're talking about race or gender or ability or language. We seem to have this idea that when we walk into a black box, or we sit down and turn on some kind of a filmic representation of something, we have rules around what constitutes that reality.
Yeah.
And I think that Ravi Jain has led us to ask all kinds of questions. Why? Why is it that deaf people should be excluded from theater? Why is it that casts of plays like this have traditionally been white? Why is it that back in the day, women weren't allowed on stage? Why is it that Laertes has to be played by a man?
Now I'll point out, too, that as you know, that conversation has progressed over maybe over the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
We often would see maybe one character adjusted or what have you. But this really says, no, we're going to go
whole
tilt here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And,
it kind of works in a way.
Yeah,
I like that about it.
I really think it does because I have ceased to think of those characters as a certain gender.
That's right.
Because I've been living so long now for with it being the way it is. And Hamlet is being played by the luminous Christine Horn. I don't think of her. Gender isn't an issue.
I felt like it was a real standout performance.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Very, very strong.
And deservingly, she was nominated for a Dora Award for it.
Yeah.
So between her and Don Janney Burley, who plays Horatio, you see best friends. You don't see two women playing two men who are best friends.
That's right.
You just see two best friends, one of whom is trying his best to help the other one through.
The only indicator becomes some of the language.
Some of the language,
Where you can't get around that unless you're willing to change it. But
exactly. I say, alas, he's mad, and, you know, but it's a woman that I'm talking about. But other than that, I mean, if that's what you're focusing on, then we're not doing our jobs properly.
That's right. And right? I agree. And I think that's the wager of the entire exercise is that it ends up being your brain starts to go with the flow of what you're watching.
Absolutely.
And you stop. You just get rid of whatever was there before and unshackle yourself from those traditional roles.
If you're willing to suspend your disbelief so far, why not further?
And who knows what that leads to?
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah, which is a wonderful
idea.
There
are worlds out there, not the least of which is our collaboration with Don Janney Burley, who first of all has translated the entire script into ASL, because she has to narrate the entire script. The whole story is told from Horatio's perspective.
It's a Herculean move, I would suggest.
And I rarely see someone work as hard as she did. So she does all of that for the purposes of the play, for her performance and for the performance as a whole. And then, you know, in her downtime, she teaches us ASL.
Right.
Because we want to communicate with this woman, and she's the one who has to teach us how.
Yeah.
Bring us into her world.
It's quite striking at the beginning. You see all the actors signing, and it's like, okay, I guess everybody's involved here.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, yeah. And we're learning.
So, youngest of four.
Yes, I am. How'd you know that?
Well, you know, I've got a few notes.
Okay.
I'm the oldest of four.
Oh, I see.
So I have a bit of an idea of...
What?
You know, the babies.
We keep it interesting. We keep it interesting. And in that, I think that for my older siblings, I was the embodiment of what they could have gotten away with had they tried hard enough.
Right. Yeah. And were you, was it an easier relationship, just generally speaking?
With my parents?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think that, I don't know, you'd have to ask my siblings. I think that...
But you are getting away with things.
I do. I mean, I have an acting career. Right. I mean, that's the big one, right? Had my older siblings said that they wanted to go into the arts in any way, I think that they would have been, you know, my parents would have sat on them, like literally, like physically.
Right.
But with me, by the time they got to me, I think they were, first of all, exhausted.
Sure.
And second of all, they were kind of like, okay, well, you know, maybe she's just going through a phase and we should just let it write itself out.
And we've tried three other ways of doing this. So.
And they seem to be fine. So this one, let's just see what happens. And I happened.
So born in the UK, is that
right? Yeah, born in England.
And
London, England.
Is that where mom and dad met or where?
No, mom and dad met in Jamaica, okay. But my father ended up getting a where my whole family's from. But my father ended up getting a scholarship to go and study in England. Okay. And so two of my siblings were born in Jamaica, and then the family moved to England, and then my older sister and I were both born in England.
And how long does that last before you?
Only 2 years.
So you don't really have memories of it or
anything? No, it was odd. I finally went back, many years later, like three decades later, and I had more of a sense of the place than I had a memory of the place. Like, right. I would walk into, say, Boots drugstores or something, the ones that really hadn't been changed for about 30 years,
right,
and feel something very, very familiar.
Yeah, it's like an old Woodward's, malt shop.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, huh, I remember it.
Yeah, like there was something genetic going, the sensors went off. But no, not really, not a pictorial memory of it.
So dad takes care of this scholarship and does that, and then it's everybody back to
Jamaica. Jamaica. Yeah.
And Kingston.
And in Kingston, the big city.
Busy place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've been to Jamaica about four or five times. And, I mean, we could spend the entire conversation just on that.
We really could.
It's a thing.
It is a thing. And it is a constantly, it's a dynamic, interesting, it can be off-putting, overwhelming. That place, obviously, I have pictorial memories of. And I find that when I go home, and I think to myself, I'm one of those lucky people who has several homes. But when I go to that home, there is something about my body that instantly is at rest.
Hmm.
But I've been in Canada now for most of my life.
Right.
So it gets to a certain point. Usually it's about the 2.5-3 week point where I think, okay, it's time to go back to that other home. Yeah.
I was fascinated to watch the Grace Jones documentary.
I haven't seen it yet.
And she goes, I mean, I think they filmed it over 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, yeah.
There, she's constantly going back. And
yeah,
you really do see a noticeable change in her.
Oh, yeah.
Sort of energy and who she is amongst, you know, her old family members and friends and so on. It's quite a... It's fascinating to watch.
Yeah, I love my country. I love that country because, you know, I also equally consider Canada my country. I love that is a part of my history and my legacy and my traditions and the food that I eat and the language that I speak when I'm among my people. I love all of that. I think that, you know, without delving deep into politics, which I really couldn't do with any kind of scholarship, but I think that as with much of the developing world, it has fallen prey to greed and imperialism and is still hanging on to the remnants of colonialism. And
Some pretty difficult conservative values there.
Yeah. Sure. And it breaks my heart. Yeah. It really does. But I see glimmers of hope. Yeah. And I see the successes. I see the international successes in Marlon James and Usain Bolt and Bob Marley and...
And the 100 Marley children.
And the 100 Marley children. You know, I see that. I have a book here by the 6th Prime Minister. I have myriad complex feelings about Jamaica.
So you get back, you're what, 2 or 3 years old, and you set up in Kingston. And, and how long does that...
That lasts 14 years.
14 years. So... Pretty big years.
Then. Yeah, and it forms me.
Yeah.
It basically forms me. I mean, I think that my love for performance was formed in Jamaica. I saw, you know, Louise Bennett Coverley doing the thing that I wanted to do, making it. She's was Jamaica's premier folklorist, and she was a poet and a dramatist and someone who took my culture and basically presented it to me and my generation as a crown.
And you would see her perform?
I would see her perform. She had a weekly show Saturday afternoons called Ring Ding. She'd sing the songs and say the poems, and kids my age, and I actually appeared on the show once, you could go and you could perform on that show. And that was such a huge gift, because it told me in subtle but undeniable ways about the value of what my people had created.
Right. So
I'm almost in tears thinking about it now, because it was so... I feel so fortunate that I had that. Yeah. Because let me tell you, there were forces, very, very active forces, countering that every day.
Yeah.
Don't speak that language. We're not. We wanted to be more British than we wanted to be Jamaican with African ancestry. I heard that my entire life growing up.
There's something about that. Follow that line. Follow that course of what's been set up for us, and it's just going to get messy if we start to talk about how this actually all came together.
Yeah.
And that's difficult for people, even people who might believe in it.
Yeah.
Believe in talking about it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Tough.
So
that wonderful influence on you, and do you start... You start performing?
There? I do. Yeah. I start performing at tea parties, of all things.
Tea parties?
Tea parties. Because we did hang on to a lot of Britishness. I don't remember. I mean, in Jamaica.
I'm from Victoria, BC. You don't need to tell me. I mean, it's built on pillars.
Exactly. Exactly, yeah. Right? But it's like 150 degrees outside and we're having tea parties. At church. But I would dress up in my bandana cloth or whatever and go up on that stage and do the Jamaican poetry. And, you know, and I think that they thought that... I can just imagine that all of my church brothers and sisters, the older crowd, probably thought that I was cute.
Church was big?
Church was huge.
Yeah.
Church was huge. Yeah. Church was... It wasn't even a question.
Yeah.
It was expected. It was, and you know what? I do credit it with giving my life structure. I knew what my weekends would bring, and it kept me out of a lot of trouble. Now,
every parent's dream.
All right? Right? I mean, exactly. It was a third parent.
Yeah.
And as I said, you know, it basically kept me... it kept me out of trouble.
So performing poetry at the tea parties, it was the singing and all that too?
And there were choirs that I got involved with, both at school and at church. There are, you know, like we have the Sears Drama Festival here, or had. We, you know, we had our version of it in Jamaica, and schools would send groups. And I was constantly on the stage, constantly doing something, going somewhere, to the extent that my parents would let me. It was where my spirit wanted me to go, and I just sort of followed it. Because
was there a sense that you knew you might have a knack for it, or was it just that, hey, this is in my blood and I'm doing it no matter what?
I knew that I had I think it was both.
Yeah.
I knew that I had a knack for it, but I think because of because, you know, I mean, my parents were a registered nurse and you know, a chartered land surveyor, and, you know, and I've had uncles who were engineers and aunties who were teachers, and I didn't see anybody in my family who was an actor. So I think it was the universe had it. It was always somewhere in my cognition. It was there. I knew that there was a possibility. I just didn't know how it was going to happen.
Right.
So for the meantime, I was just going to do it no matter what.
Yeah.
I didn't know. Yeah. I didn't know the path.
And so that kept going. And then do we start officially sort of training at that point? Or go through the programs?
Yeah. The training happened when I came to Canada. That's when the opportunity presented itself.
Okay, before we get to Canada, let me ask you, as somebody who, I mean, I love Jamaican food. I love food from that region.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm always looking for what I think might be the best representation of authenticity.
Okay.
So you must have a pick here in Toronto.
Oh my God, I don't know if I'm allowed to say that.
Oh no.
Well, I tell you what I do tell people, and I might get blowback for this.
Okay.
But I think, you know, for good business reasons, the foods of the Caribbean have sort of been conflated, and now we find that, you know, there are Jamaicans offering something that is typically Trinidadian or Guyanese, like roti.
Okay.
And there are, you know, Guyanese restaurants that are offering something that is typically Jamaican, like jerk chicken.
You're explaining the Toronto scene, basically.
We
melt everything down.
And
here,
I right. tell people, don't mix those things up.
Right.
If you want good jerk chicken,
yeah,
go to Jamaicans. If you want good roti, go to Trinidadians and Guyanese. Now listen, I am sure there are exceptions.
Sure.
And I welcome fusions. And I welcome anyone who would want to prove me wrong. But generally speaking, I have been right about that.
Okay.
I've been right about that.
That's a hot tip.
Exactly.
Yep.
So there you go. So where have I... My favorite is oxtail. Oxtail is probably the reason why vegetarianism has just not taken hold with me.
It's delicious.
I don't know. It's delicious. My go-to place when I'm on my bike and I'm coming from, you know, I don't know, some kind of appointment all the way from, say, downtown Toronto, and I'm Yonge and Bloor, and I have to come back down to my house, I ride by Mr. Jerk on Wellesley.
Right.
Between Sherbourne and Parliament.
Yeah, I know the one.
Shout out to Paul. And I go and I will, they really don't disappoint me in terms of the oxtail, in terms of the jerk chicken, in terms of their rice and peas, their coleslaw. They don't. And it's also nostalgia for me because I used to live right across the street.
I was in that neighborhood for a few years when I worked at Proud FM. I was there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I kind of got to know some of the haunts. It's changing a lot. I
mean, it really is, isn't it?
The Zeldas and all the places that I used to know. And
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the food basics is still there.
Yeah. Some things you just gotta have. Yeah.
Yeah, you just gotta have that.
Yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah, that's a really good one.
I'll tell you, some of the most vivid memories I have are stopping at a jerk chicken shack just on the side of the road somewhere down in Jamaica.
It's the best.
It's unbelievable.
Thing ever.
Yeah.
Especially when they give it to you between that piece of jerk chicken between two pieces of the white of hardo bread.
Yeah.
Fresh off the grill with some ketchup and some pepper. A
couple chickens walking around in the background, you know what I'm talking about? So amazing.
It really is. There's nothing more delicious than that.
You're listening to Art at the End of the World. My name is Mark Wigmore. My conversation with Karen Robinson continues in a moment. You're listening to the Zoomer Podcast Network. Mark Wigmore with you here on Art at the End of the World, the podcast remix. Let's get back to my talk with the wonderful Karen Robinson. So why does everybody decide Canada is the place? You must be, at this point, what, you're 16, 17?
Yeah, because I think my parents were both looking for opportunities for you know, you always want your children to do better than you did. And they wanted to just give us options. And my mother, God bless her, she is one of the bravest souls. I mean, they both are. I think people, But my mother is the one who said, okay, there's this job in this small town in Alberta, and I'm going to go get it and move my family. However, I'm going to do that. I'm going to do it. And she did it. Wow. She did it. And all these years later, I think it was 1982 or something. So where we at? What's that? 37 years later.
Yeah.
That's yet another home base.
That was the linchpin.
Yeah.
And I know you're a fan of David Cherryandy's book, Brother,
which
I love too. And I had him on one of my programs, and we talked all about it.
Yeah, but yeah.
That's the story, isn't
that's
it?
That's the story.
Yeah.
Your parents just say, okay, so there's this. What else is there? And I think that is, you know, for all their conservative Christian values, I do think that it takes a special someone, and it doesn't make them exclusive in any way, because I think people do it all over the world. I mean, we could go into migrants and all of that, but we won't. To look around and say, I could do this or I could do something else.
Right?
Even when there's not a crisis. And my family certainly wasn't in crisis, but they saw what was available.
It's big
for
family, though. I mean, I talked about moving to Nova Scotia recently, and I know my mom was, you know, nervous about it. I mean, you're going to move even further away from me and whatever. And that's just still in Canada.
So, exactly.
So it is a big
deal. It is a big thing.
Deal.
It is a big deal.
It's a life change.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's easier to do it when you're younger. Mm-hmm. But my parents were, you know, well into middle age with four children.
Right. What city was that in
Drumheller, Alberta?
Drumheller,
Alberta.
I feel like I heard that in like a Stan Lee kids book or something. You would just list off Canadian, funny Canadian city names.
Home of the largest paleontology museum. Let's go with that. Can you believe I speak for a living?
Oh, my
God. in the world.
Right.
Yeah,
and
I worked there.
So, any acting gigs in Drumheller, or?
Yes, because that's how I get. That's where I found my path, actually, because. Yeah. I went into grade 12 when I moved here and when I moved to there, and there was a school play, and I auditioned for it, and I got the part. God bless them. And won some sort of award that took me to a summer drama camp called Art Strek. In Vermilion, Alberta.
Vermilion.
And just looked around me. I was immersed in everything theater for 2 weeks. And at 17 or however old I was by then, my spirit knew, this is where it's at. I can't do anything else.
You started to see the structure of what was going on up here, and it was probably a little different than back home.
Exactly. I knew I could go to school. I knew I could pursue a diploma, then a degree, and I saw the path.
You take note, you decide this is where it's going to go. What were the steps after that?
The steps were, I remember knowing that I was going to go to Mount Royal College because I hadn't done well enough in math to get into university.
Join the club.
And look how well we've done.
We've done all right.
We needed math. What? No.
Yeah.
Anyway, I remember getting the sheet of everything that I could do, like all the possible majors I could do at Mount Royal College. And I remember my 17-year-old brain. And a 17-year-old brain back then is even younger than a 17-year-old brain right now. Yeah. But, and I think to myself, I was with it enough to look down that list and say, the only thing on this page that I could possibly do is theater.
And so you were off and running. What was the first show that you really felt like, okay, I'm part of something here that is making an impression on me, and it was meaningful to you, and that there was a character maybe that you loved performing, or what was maybe the one where you really felt, okay, I'm proud of this?
Oh, God, that's an interesting question, because of course now I'm looking back on it with all kinds of filters.
Don't we do that about a lot of things?
You know what? I know. You know when it was? I'll tell you when it was. It wasn't a show that I did. It was a scene study that that I did. The second years directed the first years in just scenes from plays that they wanted to do. And I was directed as Blanche DuBois in A Streetcar Named Desire.
Okay.
And because I didn't grow up in this culture, that wasn't a part. Like, when I was growing up in Jamaica, Streetcar Named Desire, I don't even think I even saw the movie by then. I mean, I just, somebody said, I want to direct you in this, and I went, oh, okay. And just threw myself at it. No real sense of, well, Blanche DuBois was this kind of person in this kind of age and this kind of... None of that. I just jumped in, you know, over my head and surfaced. And breathed. And I remember it wasn't only feeling like I had agency in doing that. I also remember what the reactions were to me being in that part. And in retrospect, now I realize that for all the barriers that were set up for me then, and they were there because, you know, I was a young Black woman in going to school in Calgary, Alberta, being told you were the best person who auditioned for such and such part, but we can't cast you because there were no Black people in that position in Canada at that time. I remember that. For all of that that was going on, there was a pocket of people who saw me in that role go and said, you shone in that role.
Interesting exercise in that, too, that you didn't have maybe the context for, like you point out, what that character was in other performances and so on. And it does raise that question about, you know, once a character has been put into a film and it does become iconic, it is sort of sad that that character can't be interpreted in different ways without a lot of scrutiny and so on. And I mean, I don't know that a writer would ever, you know, maybe the writer isn't even in love with what ended up in the big film or what have you. I love that idea that you were able to take that and just say, well, here's what I'm taking away from this.
And kind of out of ignorance.
Right.
Just because I didn't know.
Kids, eh?
Oh my God.
That's why all that music is great from young people and so on. They just don't have the same
Exactly. You know, that's why first albums are always so, so often, so amazing.
Yeah.
Because you are just throwing everything from your life experience into that. And, you know, and then somebody's culling it and picking out the best stuff. But it's without fame or without the sense of, what do people want to hear or what do people want from me? It's just, this is me.
Yeah, and once in a while.
Usually it's the best stuff.
They get another run at it, and they might be okay for record two, and then sometimes it starts to fall apart. You know, it's just too many forces of business.
So
you have that experience, and you're going to school there, and when does Toronto come into play?
Comes into play because, I went from our... Reader's Digest version, went from Mount Royal College to University of Calgary, barely graduated from University of Calgary. I think they kicked me out and just threw the degree after me. And worked at the Citadel Theatre in an internship after that in one of the shows under the tutelage of Robin Phillips. And one of the shows that I did there got picked up by Mirvish Productions. It was Man of La Mancha.
Right.
Starring Michael Burgess and Susan Gilmore. And I was just, you know, the little Black girl running around in the back being, you know, one of the prisoners on the ship.
Britta Johnson and I talked about this.
Did you?
Show. Yeah, she was crazy for it. So, as a kid.
Wow.
I mean, she's still practically a kid, but.
Well, yeah. Look at her design. Well,
look at her go, though.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, and so I came with the show, and I remember, I think I was walking around Little Portugal or something for some reason. I was out there. And I remember seeing rose bushes climbing up people's ironwork on their front porches. And I thought to myself, I haven't seen flowers grow like that since I left Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I need to be here. because Jamaica is only 4 hours away by plane. Yep. Because I can get a patty and a coca bread and a ting at the store on the corner.
Yeah.
And because I think I can work here.
Right.
And I was aware that work opportunities in Alberta would be few and far between. And so I think, you know, after that contract was done, I think I probably had like I had $216 in the bank, and I told my mom I was gonna be moving to Toronto. My mom, she, you know, sort of, I saw her lose her mind in her head,
right?
But what she actually did with her body and with her heart was write me a check for $100 and give it to me and say, you can come home anytime you need to. And I never cashed that check.
Isn't it funny how we have those moments? I had a very similar moment moving to Toronto as well.
Did you?
Yeah, where I was working at a restaurant and I knew I was going to be coming here. And I remember one of the women saying to me, you'll be back. You know, you'll be back here. And that was the moment where I thought, I'm never coming back.
No, honey, I'm not coming back to that.
No.
Oh, no.
No, you just sealed the deal.
You figure she's still waiting?
I have no idea. I'll never forget that moment because it made me very determined that I could make it here. And here we both are. And Soulpepper, Stratford, all the different smaller companies, Mervish, as you point out.
Yeah.
It's been a pretty solid
time for you. It's been miraculous. I describe it in, you know, being lucky and such a blessing. I really, sometimes I can't believe it myself because this business is hard and it's unfair and it's unpredictable. And I have been through the lean times where, you know, I have great neighbors around. We make great neighbors, you know, in the city and in our neighborhood. I have great neighbors who will see me out there, you know, gardening and see and can sense that something's wrong. And one of my neighbors, I remember years ago, came up and said, what's wrong? And I said, I don't have any work and I don't know what to do if I'm not acting. I that is who I am.
Right.
So I've been through those times.
Tough struggle.
Yeah.
I just went through it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Fine. So you know.
It's really, really tricky.
It really is.
To plays keep with your identity.
Exactly. Keep a sense of yourself. Who am I if I'm not doing that thing?
Yeah.
Right? And then the tricky part of being this busy, which I'm so grateful for. Thank God I have the health and the strength and, you know, but also being able to sustain relationships, whether they be intimate relationships with my partner or friendships with my neighbors and friends, it gets hard because you only have so much time and so much energy and so much space. But that is the stuff. But I know it's important because that's the stuff that is going to sustain you when those hard times come along.
You learn it. It's a tough lesson to learn, but
yeah.
I think that you raise a great point. Your priorities do start to change a little bit. And somehow that's helpful in your professional life.
Yeah. Yeah, you know? It really is.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, so I've made mistakes and I've had friends who have broken up with me. And then I have the friends who do hang on no matter what. And I'm so grateful for them. And I try. I get up every morning and I meditate and I try again.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's working for you? How long has that been going on?
The meditation?
Yeah.
I'm a recent convert. I would say I've been doing it on and off for the last year.
Wow.
And I really
pretty new.
Do, yeah, really new. And I really, do, you know, there are other ways that I've been going about, like structuring my day, whether it be, you know, going to the gym or gardening or whatever. But there's always a form of some me time. So lately what it's been is it's meditation. And I can certainly see the difference in my days, in my sense of clarity, in having the eye that can tell when it's not the world against me, it's how I'm approaching the world that is the issue. It's been instructive.
Something you brought up earlier was that moment when you were in early casting and you were very good at a role and you knew that you had something to bring to the table.
Mm-hmm.
But people told you, it doesn't matter how good you are here, you are not what we are looking for. And there's a whole myriad of reasons as to why that is. We're not brave enough to change things. It's never been done like that before. So on and so forth. So paint a picture for us from that 25 years ago, 30 years ago of what that was for you, because it was probably pretty specific in that Alberta setting and that early Toronto setting. What were some of those challenges that you were facing as a young black woman in Canada trying to get these roles?
You know, the most specific thing that I can remember is hearing those words time and again, swallowing those words.
Hard on the system.
It's hard on the system. And even though those words would sometimes make me angry, they never made me bitter. And I don't know why. It's not necessarily something that I worked on. I think it was because I come from a long line of pragmatists. And even though this is what I do, and I understand what a gift and what a huge responsibility it is, I'm not sort of hugely philosophical about it. At the end of the day, I know that I have to have a roof over my head and I have to have food to eat. I have to be able to take care of myself. I remember telling my cousin, one of the people who have hung on to me, even though, you know, she barely hears from me these days, I remember telling her back then, when I first started out, if in 5 years I tell you that I don't know how I'm going to pay my rent, or I don't know where my next meal is coming from, give me a swift kick in the butt and tell me to go get a job. So whenever I heard those words, I think my spirit naturally went to what's next. Do I have to temp for a while? When's the next audition? You know, who can help me get to the next level? I actually was ballsy enough to ask people that question. One woman tells me every now and again that she met me at a party once, and I said to her, "So what can you do for me?"
We get to that point sometimes. I might have had a few conversations like that recently.
Oh, dear God. Anyway.
But that's very much the acting arc.
Yeah. You know,
people go through that. But you're also dealing with this issue, as you point out, that there's just certain roles that it would have been a hopeless quest on some level. And I feel like that
still are.
might be changing. I don't know if it's quite to the level that the arts and culture world would like to present to the public.
Yeah.
But it feels like there is some incremental change.
There is, I do believe so. I do believe that I have benefited from those changes. I mean, I think that I'd be disingenuous if I said otherwise. I have benefited, well, right now, playing Gertrude.
Right.
You know, I have a white husband and my son is white.
Right.
And I'm not batting an eye. That's my child on stage. I agree with you. I do think it's changing. I do think that we have to keep pushing.
Because there's the intention to change, and then there's the bedrock and the reality of what the actual system is.
Exactly. Right? There's putting your money where your mouth is. And there are also all those minds, right? There are all those minds which have gotten so comfortable in what they're accustomed to. And you're challenging those minds. Those minds oftentimes come with deep pockets. And if you don't do things their way, then, you know, you don't have access to the means in order to do your work. So it's a continuing challenge. Yes, there have been changes. More so in theater than on film, than on screen, I should say. That's what I'm looking for.
Right.
I'm looking for that explosion.
It's interesting because I think we're going to see you know, the Oscars, and that continues to be this parade of like, hey, we're trying to. I think it does fall on the arts and culture community to be ahead of the curve on some of these issues, because
when hasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And so there has been a response since Oscar So White a couple of years back, but as you point out, there's what they parade out on mm-hmm. one night of the year, mm-hmm. and then there's the reality of what everybody's at, the nuts reality. And bolts yeah. of the actual machinery of the film business.
Absolutely. And television Absolutely. Business. It's not only about what's on the stage, what's going on behind the stage, what's going on behind the camera. Yeah, whose stories are we telling?
Your IMDb, though, is pretty impressive.
Is it?
It's huge.
Compared to who?
You've been in a million things.
I have. Yeah, I have.
It's not so bad.
No. It is huge.
Yeah.
It is huge.
A lot of shows.
Yes, which I will say again, very grateful for. Put a roof over my head. I'm able to take care of myself. I'm able to take care of the people around me to a certain extent. Certainly my parents who are getting old, I can, they know that they're covered.
Right.
They've covered themselves, but if they need help, they know that their children can help them. So there's that. The question, what I would say back to you is, for all of that work that is on my IMDb page, mm-hmm. how many times are those stories about me?
Right. That is the what we're talking about.
That's what we're talking
about. To be sure.
It's slow. It's taking its time. And it's onerous. It feels like pulling teeth, because you also don't want to be the person, or it's difficult to be the person, the yeah but person.
The business, the actually person. The business model too is it's got to be, like you point out, there's investors out there, there's money that comes from certain people. They've seen it work a certain way, mm-hmm. and there's just maybe no roadmap for these other stories being told. And then you do a Black Panther or something like that, and everybody goes, oh, right.
Right. Exactly.
So talk to me about the city right now. You and I live about 2 minutes apart from mm-hmm. each other. Great neighborhood.
Yeah, love it.
But over the last year, a bit rocky, a lot of violence. And we're seeing, we're talking about this before we got started, wealth inequality. Mm-hmm. We worry about people being able to afford mm-hmm. anything mm-hmm. in this town. Mm-hmm. What's your take on our city right now?
I love our city.
Yeah.
I do.
I feel protective of going too far down San Francisco or New York or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do. It really is my home, and it's been very good to me. It's funny, I was talking to some of my castmates yesterday who live on the East End, and I said, have you noticed that the ridership of the Queen car has changed lately? And I think I've noticed it because I've been away working so much, whether it's Stratford or, going somewhere to shoot or that sort of thing. So I come back and, get back into my life and start, doing what I do, and that includes riding the Queen car. What I've noticed is that there are a lot more people displaying signs of poverty, homelessness, and mental distress mm-hmm. on the streetcar. And it's discomforting.
Yeah.
It is. Because,
Toronto Life did a recent piece in the last couple of weeks.
Oh, did they?
Addressing a bit of this. Yeah.
Yeah. Because if I'm absolutely real about it, I get used to my neighborhood and the people in my neighborhood sort of being like me, and we all have a certain lifestyle level and way of going about our daily lives that is acceptable and considered normal. Mm-hmm. And then you get this reality thrown at you.
Yeah.
Those are the people who are living outside of the margins of our little neighborhood.
And if we're seeing an increase,
yeah,
we know that something's going on.
Awry. Yeah. Something's awry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's concerning.
It is very concerning. And I think there is the usual response of flight. Mm-hmm. You sell up, you move somewhere where you feel safer or something like that. But I also, I think the better, the kinder response is, the more progressive response is to find out what is going on and address that.
Tough work, though.
It really is. It's tough work, and it takes such incredible courage and bravery, because it's tough work. It's also expensive. Mm-hmm. And it means that we're all going to have to pay for it in some way. And by and large, people don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Why should I have to somehow lose something, even though so many of us have more than enough? Why do I have to lose anything in order to help somebody out there who, and usually the trope is, just doesn't want to go get a job? You know, or just won't behave properly.
Mm-hmm.
Why doesn't somebody else do something?
That stuff's getting pretty old.
Yeah.
Stinks up the joint.
It really does.
Yeah.
It really does. And I actually have to look in the mirror first.
Right.
Like, you know?
It's fair.
We
can get judgy.
We can get judgy. But I know I will pay.
Right.
I will pay in order to have a city that is here for everybody.
It's hard. We live in
a
moment of people want change all the time. They want they want results quickly.
Mm-hmm.
We're paid off so easily in our lives with the info and technology that we have at our fingertips.
Yeah.
And that, you know, as Obama pointed out, those are incremental changes that
won't happen
maybe even in your lifetime.
I remember him talking about the ocean liner, what it's like in order to get to have a real change. God, I miss that man.
Ah! I don't know what you mean.
That was my outside voice. Anyway, it's like turning an ocean liner.
How's Stratford been for you? It seems like that's been a pretty good run.
It's been 6 seasons over. I think my first season was 2002, so it's 6 seasons over 17 years.
You like being out there? And
yeah, I
do. You set up camp over there and kind of move over?
I'm really good at, you know, piling up a van and moving what I need and setting up home and settling in and made my
friends. It's its own little world over there.
It really is. I mean, there's not. Yeah, God, you know, you need to sort of chill out or whatever. You walk down to the Avon River and watch the swans. You know, it's also hard work.
Right.
And all you also get there in the wintertime, and winter in Stratford is a freaking doozy.
Right.
And so you have to work through that, and then the spring starts happening. But it's such a it's a really lovely place to be. And one thing that I've noticed is when I've done a season there, but I come back to Toronto because, you know, I have responsibilities here that I need to take care of. It is a shock to stand at the corner of Queen and Spadina, like coming from Stratford.
Right.
Like, this city assaults you. I do miss the city.
Sure.
I miss the city when I'm in Stratford, and I'm happy to come home when the season is over. But whoa, once you get used to Sunday afternoons in Stratford.
Sure.
Once your body settles into that, coming back to Toronto on a busy Friday, whew.
I just lived in Algonquin Park for the entire summer.
Yeah.
And you can imagine.
Yeah.
It was exactly what you're talking about. My goodness.
I know. So there, you know, there are pluses and minuses.
Yeah.
God knows.
So Schitt's Creek comes along and, you know, Dan and Eugene are putting this thing together. And was it just a audition and the rest is history?
It was an audition. It was a callback. It was a callback with, I think I was told that it was going to be Dan and Eugene.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sitting there in the waiting room, and Dan came through and said, hi. I said, how are you doing? I said, I'm really nervous.
Pretty approachable guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I said, I'm really nervous. He said, oh, don't be nervous. And they told me that Eugene was, you know, he was shooting some scene when he and Moira go to a cottage or what was supposed to be a cottage, and he was climbing through a window or something like that. So he couldn't be there for the audition. He was kind of busy. And and had that third audition, then booked the gig. And
it's been nice.
Really, no. I knew the name.
Right.
But then I knew Catherine O'Hara was in it, and I knew those names.
I was just thinking about the Christopher Guest films, Waiting for Guffman and Best in Show.
I knew those.
And I thought to myself, is this where we're going? And it is a little different, but there is shades of that, too.
Absolutely. And because those projects were so collaborative, right?
Yeah.
So there a lot of the same genius that Eugene and Catherine offered to those projects are there in spades.
Big time. And what's been nice is that, of course, your relationship with Catherine has been explored, you know, off and on throughout all the seasons that they've come along.
Yeah.
Must be fun.
Ronnie
to get
and
together
Moira.
With, get together and cut another yet another scene together.
I know.
You're always a little, you know, rolling your eyes at Moira and just dealing the best you can.
Yeah. Well, I just have to observe her, really. The camera just has to catch me observing Moira. And it's real because it's the genius of Catherine O'Hara because she's unstoppable, because she is unflaggingly creative. She is fearless. And, you know, and I speak about her because, of course, she's that force, but it's all of them. It
yeah.
really is. I feel like I'm in the company of geniuses. I feel like, you know, I can do a take and Eugene can be behind the camera and come up to me and whisper, maybe you should put the emphasis on this word instead of that word.
Right.
And, you know, it'll change the world. Wow. I feel like I'm in the best company and I'm just along for the ride.
It's been interesting to me too, because I think the first season found its footing and just its tone and so on. And I think, you know, I always encourage people, like, keep going if that's the only place you've visited so
Absolutely.
Far, because it really has, as each season has gone on, it's been a real joy to watch it flower and find its way and find its voice and its tempo and all of it.
And isn't that what a lot of the articles were talking about too, is the joy that Schitt's Creek brings? And I've heard Dan talk about it too, that is something that people really need in these times of polarities and differences and us and them. And
people really believe that the Marie Kondo Netflix show, The Tiding, that's the secret of its success. Very similar. Just a nice warm hug in your day. And Schitt's Creek is often that.
Schitt's Creek is often that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's beautiful. There's the scene where David is hugging his boyfriend, Patrick, because Patrick decided that, you know, he wanted to just be with David and nobody else. And Patrick says, this is a really long hug. And David says, just one more minute. That's kind of what Schitt's Creek is like.
Yeah.
It's a good hug that, in the words of one of my best friend's mother, it lasts as long as it lasts.
Yeah.
Let the hug last.
Yeah.
Don't end it before it's supposed to be over.
Weirdly, I mean, it makes me emotional just to talk about it, but it is amazing how catty some of the characters can be towards each other. But you are, often in that season finale, you are feeling your heart being pulled out.
Absolutely.
You know, it's truly great for that.
Yeah.
And it's exciting. I love seeing you in it.
Thank you. I love being in it.
Yeah.
And it really does mean a lot that people enjoy it, that you enjoy it. And my friends do. And then people who I don't know do. I just think, oh my God, I get to be part of this thing that is so important to people. Mm-hmm. Like they just, it really feeds them. I love that.
Karen Robinson, you're the best, and I'm so glad. It was fun to hang out with you and have dinner, and it's been really fun to hang out with you and have a glass of water and enjoy this conversation.
Thank you, Mark Wigmore. I'm so glad that we were able to finally do this. I'm sorry it took so long, but it's been worth it.
Oh, my goodness. Wasn't she great? What a charmer and thoughtful and just wonderful person. Just love Karen. And you can watch her on CBC Television, The Pop Network, and Netflix as Ronnie in Season 6 of Schitt's Creek. That's it. Don't forget you can listen to episodes of Art at the End of the World at classicalfm.ca or artattheendoftheworld.com. And everywhere you enjoy listening to podcasts, you can subscribe at iTunes and Stitcher.
on and on and on. Thank you once again to our sponsors today, Red Eye Media and Crow's Theater. And thanks to you. Thanks for checking out the show. We're on Facebook. Twitter is at Art at the End. My Instagram handle is at Wigdad. We're back on Monday with a fresh conversation from Crow's Theater, the great Chris Abraham, a major player in the Canadian theater scene. Looking forward to speaking with Chris. And don't forget, you can hear my program, The Oasis, on the new Classical FM weekdays, 3 to 7 p.m. Eastern, 12 to 4 Pacific, at classicalfm.ca. You can watch the broadcast live on YouTube and Classic FM in Toronto at 96.3, Cobourg at 103.1, and Collingwood at 102.9. There's another edition of Art at the End of the World Remix. We're back on Monday. Speak to you then and for as long as we can.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.